Revelation chapter 11, verse 19 through chapter 12, verse 6, Tribulation Personality, segment number 12. When the time comes during the tribulation, when the Antichrist turns against the Jewish people with whom he has made a treaty of peace, because he turns upon them because they will not worship him as God, they immediately are warned that they must flee for their lives. Jesus warned them centuries ago that they must be careful to do this. Jesus predicted that this would happen during the tribulation and that the Jews should seek refuge in a desert area, a mountainous area. Only about 1 million of the 3 million Jews of Palestine will escape to safety. A map of Palestine shows that the only isolated mountain area safe for the Jews is southeast of the Dead Sea in the territory of what was once ancient Edom, and particularly the interesting city of Petra that has for centuries fascinated mankind. The Old Testament very clearly refers to this city. It's called Seir, S-E-I-R, and it is a specific place of refuge, and it may be the place to which the Jews will flee. The entrance into Petra, which lies in the cauldron of a dead volcano, is a very narrow, winding, 2-mile-long canyon corridor with high walls. Petra has chambers carved out of rose-colored sandstone, which is suitable for housing people. Petra was in time abandoned and was actually forgotten for 600 years until it was rediscovered in 1812. It seems that Petra may be the safe haven that God has prepared for the fleeing tribulation Jews, where they may escape because of the difficulty of the terrain, because of the difficulty of being pursued here, because of the problems that the Antichrist himself will be having with other nations attacking him at that time, and no doubt because also God himself will place a canopy of protection over the Jews in this condition, in this refuge. He will furthermore provide for them, we're told, food for 3.5 years to carry them to the end of the tribulation period. The Antichrist's mid-tribulation attack against the Jews will, of course, Jesus said, be their greatest era of suffering. Persecuting the Jews as a people is an irrational act, but it is not over yet. The intense hatred toward the Jews, of course, as we pointed out some time ago, is the work of Satan. If you ask why do people hate the Jews, why are societies and various nations so antagonistic to the Jewish people, it is because of Satan's hatred, who instigates hatred against this people through the sin natures of unregenerate men and women. But that still raises the interesting question of why there is this enormous obsession with a little piece of real estate that constitutes the land of Israel, why the Arab nations are so obsessed with taking this small territory of Israel when they have the vast surrounding territories of Arab nations, powerful, wealthy, oil wealth. They don't need that little piece of land called Israel. Why the battles over Israel? The background of the hatred for the Jews goes back to the end of the 19th century relative to recent times. At that time, there was a man named Theodor Herzl who formed the World Zionist Organization in order to begin promoting a homeland for the Jewish people. Now, Herzl was an interesting man because he had another plan which preceded this one. He asked the Pope for an audience. He wanted to speak with the Pope, and he wanted to present a plan that if the Pope would throw his weight to influence the nations of the world and the leaders of the world where Catholicism was dominant, not to attack the Jews, not to persecute the Jewish people, Herzl was going to promise the Pope that he would set up an organization to try to convert Jews to Roman Catholicism so that they would be received by the Roman Catholic Church and they would come under the care of the Pope. The thing that dissuaded him from this plan was that shortly before this event in 1897, when he formed the Zionist organization, was that in France, there was an artillery officer named Alfred Dreyfus. Alfred Dreyfus was of Jewish extraction. He was a fully integrated Frenchman, but he was elevated to a staff position. It was unheard of that a Jew would be elevated to a staff position in the French army. This raised a great deal of antagonism, and in the course of events, a letter was forged to imitate the handwriting of Dreyfus, in which he declared that he would reveal certain top secret documents to the Germans. And indeed, that information was leaked to the Germans, and this document was used to convict Alfred Dreyfus of treason. He was sent to Devil's Island. He was as innocent as could be. All they had was, "This looks like your handwriting." But what was behind it was hatred for him as a Jew. There were other men, however, in France who were incensed at this miscarriage of justice, and so they pursued the matter even at personal loss. Some of them military men who got sent off to Timbuktu, out of the way places, for service in order to quiet them down. They did not quiet down. They pursued it, and lo and behold, they uncovered the evidence that this letter was a forgery, and that indeed secrets had been leaked to the Germans, but it was done by another French officer who was of royal extraction. The French army found it unthinkable to try an officer from the royalty as a traitor. And so they covered it over and insisted that there was no evidence, that this evidence was not brought to a new trial, and Dreyfus kept waning away in Devil's Island, which, as you may know, was the worst prison situation in which a Frenchman could be sent. As time went by, however, events demonstrated that the royal officer was guilty of other crimes, and then admitted that he had forged the letter. Alfred Dreyfus was completely exonerated. Did they release him from Devil's Island? No, they gave him, instead of a life sentence, 10 years. And then going to release him, they couldn't admit that they had attacked a man who was a Jew and had put him in prison on such flimsy evidence. Some of the great French writers at that time took up the cause, and when Clemenceau became Premier of France, who was a man who understood what a miscarriage of justice this had been, and who himself had been championing the cause of Dreyfus under Clemenceau, Alfred Dreyfus was exonerated. He was restored to his position. He actually became a general, and the men who had been in the army, who had been championing his cause, went up to top ranks along with him. When Theodore Herzl watched this drama unraveling around Dreyfus, it hit him square between the eyes that the world is never going to accept the Jew. As long as you keep your place as a Jew, okay. But once you come into certain positions that they consider beyond the proper realm of the Jewish people to be participants in, Herzl realized that the Jews would be under persecution and attack. So he changed his mind about the plan with the Pope, and instead he came to the conclusion what the Jews need is a homeland again. And where they need that homeland is where God gave them the promised land in the first place, there on the Mediterranean Sea.
So in 1897, the first World Zionist Congress was held in Basel, Switzerland. And at that Congress, Herzl made an interesting prediction. He predicted that within 50 years, there would be a homeland for the Jews in the old promised land. Israel, of course, is in a strategically located position. In the larger map, you would see this a little easier, but you see that Israel is the crossroads of three continents, from Europe, Africa, and Asia. That's what's so amazing about this little country. That's why everybody wants it. That's why they're squabbling over it. It is a strategic location, and nobody can make great moves, whether you're playing Risk or whether you're playing the real thing, without taking into account the location of Israel. It is at the crossroads of three continents. So Israel, in this strategic location and in proximity to very important waterways, the Mediterranean Sea, the Red Sea, and the Suez Canal, also add to its importance. Israel itself is a small country. You can cover it one from east to west in an hour and a half by car, and in a couple three hours in the other direction, and yet for centuries it has been coveted. Theodor Herzl himself claimed that Palestine rightly belongs to the Jews. He did not accept the argument that the Jews have not lived there for a long time and therefore they had lost their right to the promised land. He pointed out that Jews, in some numbers, have always lived in that area of Palestine. Furthermore, he said by divine decree of God having granted this land to Israel, that anybody else who is there as a resident, such as the Arabs, are squatters, or they have come in as foreign conquerors, and that's why they are there. So Herzl was not intimidated by the fact that people said the Jew has been out of this land for a long time. Other people have taken it, and it's theirs now. Another famous Zionist was a man named Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann rendered enormous service to Britain during World War I. A critical chemical in making explosives was acetone. Britain had been importing this from Germany. Suddenly, Britain found herself at war with Germany, and acetone in short supply and no place to get more because the Germans had a monopoly on it. They turned to Chaim Weizmann, a chemist, and said, "Can you help us out? Can you get a substitute?" And lo and behold, indeed, I suspect, by divine providence, Weizmann came up with a synthetic cordite that enabled Britain to make all the explosives she needed of every kind. Weizmann saved the hide of the British Empire. The British government, in appreciation for the enormous thing that this Jewish man had done for the British people, issued a statement called the Balfour Declaration. Balfour, B-A-L-F-O-U-R. The Balfour Declaration on November 2nd, 1917. And in it, they declared that the British government was in favor of the establishment of a Jewish homeland in the ancient promised land of Palestine. They did this out of respect and gratitude to Chaim Weizmann, who had joined the Zionist movement and was seeking to establish such a homeland for the Jewish people. The American president, Woodrow Wilson, himself was in favor of this, and Britain actually signed the Balfour Declaration at the strong urgings of President Wilson. So the United States had a part in bringing this policy about. On December 9th, 1917, during World War I, the British captured Jerusalem. General Allenby walked in, took it without a shot being fired. Another providential action. Suddenly, the key city of the Promised Land was now in the hands of the British. Within a short order, they controlled all of Palestine, and on July 24, 1922, the newly formed League of Nations, the predecessor of our current United Nations, the League of Nations expressed approval of the Balfour Declaration for a Jewish homeland. So what you had now was among the Gentile powers of the world, Britain committed to creating a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. Now it spread to an international commitment through the League of Nations that the Jew was to be able to go back and form a nation in his old homeland. Britain, again, expressed itself in favor of establishing a country for the Jews in Palestine, and in order to bring this about, they actually set up a civil administrator of the Palestine territory who was a Jew. So things were moving now in high gear. It looked like the Zionist movement was finally going to do something for the Jewish people to get them out from under running around the world trying to find a place of refuge. Well, in the wings was another group of people called the Arabs. The Arabs of Palestine naturally, vehemently objected to Britain's promotion of a Jewish nation in the territory of Palestine. The two sons of Ishmael, from whom the sons of Ishmael, from whom the Arabs came, hated the sons of Isaac, from whom the Jews came. Well, what the Jews did with this encouragement from Britain and the League of Nations was begin to move into Palestine, and they bought up the land from Arabs and from Turks who did not want the territory. The only way they got land was by gradually buying bit by bit and paying for it. All of this with British approval. Suddenly, with the rise of Hitler on the eve of World War II, anti-Semitism again went into high gear, and migration to Palestine grew enormously. Actually, earlier on, there were some Jews around the world who weren't too keen on the idea of a homeland for the Jew. They weren't too excited about the Zionist movement because, like American Jews, they had been integrated in American society. They viewed themselves as American. They weren't really particularly fond of the idea of going back and having another country there in Palestine. But with the rise of Hitler's Germany and the anti-Semitism there, Jewish migration picked up considerable speed as Jews from various European countries saw the handwriting up on the wall and the smart ones got out. The Arabs, of course, reacted with indignation, but they couldn't do anything about it because Britain was saying, come on in, come on in. We're going to set up a nation. Come on in. So the Arabs resorted to terrorism. And they put severe pressure upon England. And when, by the time 1935 came along, and it was evident that war was looming on the horizon in Europe, the British had a new fear that they had to take into account. The Arabs had the oil. If they went to war, the Arabs would deny them access to the oil because the Arabs were sympathetic with Nazis. They were sympathetic to the Germans. And so therefore, in order to try to protect themselves, the British government decided to start undercutting the Balfour Declaration of a homeland for the Jews. And they began putting limitations on the Jews that could immigrate into Palestine. The Jewish Zionists, however, proceeded in the meantime while Jews were being restricted from coming into Palestine now, those who were there proceeded to organize a basic structure of government. They created an underground army, the Haggadah, and they set up various government agencies in just a format structure, all in preparation for the day when they would become a nation, so everything was ready to go when that happened. During World War II, the Jews of Palestine fought with the British. After World War II, the British people, fed up with the war, fed up with the hardships they'd been through, the shortages, bought into socialism. And they bit the hook of the Labour, British Labour Party, and they cast out Winston Churchill and the Conservative Party and brought in the Socialist Party, the Labour Party. The Labour Party was not sympathetic toward the Jews, and they virtually stopped immigration into Palestine, and in fact, thus virtually completely rescinded the Balfour Declaration. Now it was the turn of the Jews to become enraged, and they became so angry that they resorted to what the Arabs had been doing. They resorted to terrorism against their former ally, Britain. On one occasion, they blew up the King David Hotel with an enormous amount of casualties, which was a major British center. Britain tried, in one way or another, to maintain peace in Palestine between the Arabs and the Jews. All the while, Britain getting more and more resentful of the terrorist attacks upon them by the Jews, whom they had previously tried to help. By 1947, Britain had had enough. The war was over. The Labour government wanted nothing to do with the Jews, and so the British handed the problem over to the United Nations and said, "We're getting out." The United Nations began discussing this problem, and they arrived at the decision that Palestine should be divided between Jews and Arabs, with Jerusalem under international control. The Arabs were infuriated. They would have no part with the idea of dividing the land, and what they wanted was the land to be under Arab control and the Jews kept as a minority population. Britain herself was increasingly angered by the Jewish terrorism directed against them, so Britain sat in the United Nations in New York and they refused to enter the debate. As a matter of fact, their ambassador had been given instructions by the government to vote with the Arabs when it came to voting on whether to divide the land and create a homeland for the Jews. By the time it came to a vote, they couldn't quite get themselves to do that, so they did not vote. They abstained. Russia herself began supporting the Jews because she saw an opportunity to get a toehold in the Middle East, which she wanted to get. Plus, by supporting the Jews, she felt she was driving a wedge between Britain, who was now antagonistic to the Jews, and the United States, who was sympathetic to the Jews. Well, on November 19th, it all came to a head. November 19th, 1947, the UN took the vote, and they voted overwhelmingly for partition of Palestine and the creation of a Jewish homeland. Well, war between the Arabs and the Jews in Palestine immediately became a great and serious possibility. On May the 14th, 1948, the British High Commissioner terminated the British mandate over Palestine, packed up his bags, and left the country. And so ended the British participation in this, very angry, very indignant against the Jew. Before the British left, they took the trouble to turn over all their military installations to the Arabs as a final gesture of their resentment against the Jews. Makes you wonder, this dramatic change on the part of Britain, when for centuries she had been a sympathizer and a protector of the Jew and had prospered into an enormous empire, now she turns against the Jew, and following this action, it has been downhill for the British Empire ever since. She's turned into a third or fourth rate world power. On the day, however, that the British did leave, the General Zionist Council in Tel Aviv at 4 o'clock in the afternoon proclaimed the establishment of the nation of Israel as per the United Nations decision. On the same day, across the sea in Washington at 5:16 p.m., President Harry Truman announced the American recognition of Israel as a nation. Within a space of a few hours, the unbelievable had happened. A nation had been born again. There was now a government in place of the Jewish people. They had a nation back there on the territory of the old promised land, and the most important nation on the face of the earth had recognized them as a nation. Others would therefore follow. They had prepared a flag for the nation in preparation for this event, and they immediately raised it as the emblem of the new nation. It looks like this. Two equilateral triangles, one on top of another. One triangle very carefully positioned so that it points heavenward toward God. The other triangle very carefully pointed toward the land, the promise that God had given them. And then, as per the statement in Numbers 15, verses 38 through 40, where God told them to mark a blue stripe or tassel on the bottom of their garments to remind them to obey the commandments of God. So the flag of Israel has these two blue stripes to remind the Jews to obey the Torah, to obey the Word of God. This is the flag that was then raised. This is the flag, if you visit Israel, that you will see flying to this day. Now the Jews were faced with making stick their declaration of nationhood. The first of a series of wars then came into their experience. Number one was their war for independence. The Arabs of Palestine and the surrounding countries immediately joined forces for a war of extermination of the Jews and of their new nation. The British government thought it would be over in a matter of a few days, and the Jews would be defeated, the nation would be squelched, and that would be the end of it. Britain was really, really indignant at the Jews now. On all accounts, the Arab troops and equipment were far superior than anything the Jews had. The Jews had an air force, two Piper Cubs. The Jews had rifles, one for every 4 or 5 men. The Jews had a navy, some old dumpy boats, including the Exodus, that had run the blockade on which the movie was made, you know, about which the movie was made, as Jews were trying to get around the British blockade to get into the promised land at the height of Hitler's pursuit of them. The Arabs outnumbered the Jewish soldiers 40-1. The Arab soldiers had been trained, many of them, by Britain herself. They were top quality troops. These were not your typical, ordinary, run-of-the-mill, flea-bitten Arabs. These guys knew how to fight, they had been trained, and they were well-equipped in terms of the population. There were 100 Arabs to every one Jew in the Promised Land. That is, 100 Arabs of the population of the Arab country against one Jewish person. And in military equipment, they had odds of 1,000-1 in favor of the Arabs. The Jews had very little, obviously, with which to work, and the military installations were now all in the hands of the Arabs. The Arabs and the British thought it would be over very quickly indeed. What happened? If you were living then, some of you older folks, the world was astonished to see the Jewish forces driving the Arab armies back across their borders. I mean, there had been a siege for I don't know how long at Sodom, down in the Negev desert. They broke that. They pushed the Egyptians back across their border. They shoved the armies in the north back. They moved Syria back. They shoved Jordan across the river. And the world is standing there watching this ridiculous scene of this little handful of a weak British, weak Israeli army cutting a powerful Arab force to pieces. The Israeli forces immediately began picking up equipment. They began picking up funds. They began picking up volunteers, and day by day, they became stronger. The Arabs were on the run. They were humiliated, and the Israeli army pursued them. Britain and the United States then stepped in and stopped the Israeli offensive. When they saw what was happening, when they saw that the Jew was going to take all of Palestine, as a matter of fact, they were headed for the Sinai Peninsula, the territory very important to right here, to Egypt, the United States and Britain put the screws on Israel and said to them, you must stop. They ended up with 8,000 square miles of territory. It was all this area here, whatever isn't crosshatched, is what they ended up with. From north to south, to Eilat, and it was a very odd-shaped country. That's where it stopped. The Jews could move in this area. They could not go through this territory here. They were the Golan Heights here. A high elevation was in the hands of Syria, and the Syrians used it constantly as an artillery base to shell Israeli settlements. The Gaza Strip here was in the hands of Egypt, and it was a high position, again, a defensive position, from which they also shelled Israeli settlements. So they were in a pretty bad situation. These are not borders that one can defend. But they had won by the grace of God in the face of impossible odds. Once more, the Jewish state, which the Romans had terminated in 70 AD, was a reality. The Jews really did have a homeland again. While the Arabs seethed with renewed hatred for the Jew, they refused to recognize Israel's existence, and they proceeded to plan their revenge. In order to try to keep some peace here, the United Nations sent a peacekeeping force to stand here in the Sinai as a buffer between Egypt and the Israelis, because Egypt is the key. The Arabs can never win a war against the Jew without Egypt. And therefore, they felt if they could keep Egypt in check and the Israelis on the other side, they might have some peace. Well, the Israeli people, the Jewish people, proceeded to build a nation. Arab political leaders, in the meantime, kept repeating their goals of eliminating Israel as a nation. Arab terrorists infiltrated Israel to keep up the pressure on them and on this rapidly developing nation, because now people started pouring into Palestine, into the new nation of Israel. Jews from all over the world were ready to become part of it. In 1967, Egypt was led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, and he mobilized the Arabs to fulfill his dream of driving the Jew into the sea. Nasser first ordered the UN peacekeeping forces, which were stationed in the Sinai, to get out and go home. The Western nations, interestingly enough, remained silent. They didn't give a peep. They didn't say anything. They let Nasser remove that UN force, and that left Israel to face once more the onslaught from Egypt, the key, as well as the nations around. On June the 5th, 1967, our newspapers again burst an unbelievable headline. The Arabs attacked Israel with an unbelievably huge force. But the Jews fought back with courage and skill, and they had a great leader in Moshe Dayan, you know, the guy with the black patch on his eye, who knew his way around in military matters. The Jews by this time were well equipped, well trained by American equipment and help, and the Jews all over the world began pounding on the doors of embassies to get immediate visas because they wanted to go to Israel to help fight the Arabs. I think it was at this time that Fiddler on the Roof was being filmed, if not this one in the Yom Kippur War, where Netevye, you know, the old milkman that played that part, a very famous Jewish actor, he told them they had to stop filming. He had to go home immediately. He was part of the defense force, and he left. Well, funds began to pour in, but things were over in 6 days. In 6 days, this is why it's called the Six-Day War, in 6 days, Israel was victorious. The Jordanians were flung back across their borders, back into Jordan, and worst thing of all that could possibly happen, they lost the West Bank. This is what is referred to that you're hearing about in the news as the West Bank. This whole territory was taken by the Jews, including Jerusalem right there, and including the Wailing Wall, the most sacred site to Jews today, the one thing that's left of the old Solomonic Temple. You can perhaps understand why the Israeli soldiers were so moved to tears as they came charging up to that wall, a wall that for something like 20 years or so the Arabs would not let them visit, would not let them touch, would not let them come to. The Arabs so hated the Jews, they would not allow them to come up to the Wailing Wall. Now those soldiers charged in, and they had it. And they had all of this area. They moved against the Syrians, and they took the Golan Heights. They moved against Egypt, and they took the Gaza Strip. Now they were bordered on the Jordan River. Now they had the high ground of the Golan Heights, the high ground of the Gaza Strip. Now they had defensive positions. Now they had a perimeter that they could indeed defend effectively. Not only did they capture Jerusalem and the temple intact, but they rolled down here and the Sinai Peninsula fell into their hands. The Israeli army now turned and wheeled its way toward Cairo in the north and headed for Damascus in Syria. The Arabs screamed for help. They quit smacking their fleas and they started yelling to the Western powers to come and save them. You know what happened? The United States got on the phone to the government of Israel and said, you have to halt the attack. Because if they permitted them to continue, they would have destroyed those armies and it would not have been a problem in the future. Now, we have taught you the doctrines of warfare, the principles of the doctrine of warfare, one of which is that the way you make peace is that you make it impossible for your enemy to make war. Very simple principle. Very simple tactical principle. You so destroy your enemy's ability to make war by removing his armies and his materiel that then you will have peace. And that's exactly what the Jews were out to do. But the United States stopped them dead in their tracks. And the Jews had to listen because we are their military supporters, are the equipment and financial supporters. They could not ignore the United States. Well, the defeated and dismayed Arabs called a summit at Khartoum in August 1967, the famous place where Chinese Gordon the man who had found the real tomb of Jesus, the garden tomb just outside the wall of Jerusalem, Chinese Gordon, a great biblical scholar and a great British general. It was at this city at Khartoum where he faced that mob and where he was killed as the British dawdled and diddled and fooled around for weeks on end before in the process of bringing up reinforcements and bringing up the forces that were needed to save him. Well, they met in this very famous city. They reviewed their defeat. Then they turned and asked Russia for help. They turned to the oil-rich Gulf chiefdoms and asked them for financial help, and they proceeded to form a new plan to destroy Israel. They reiterated their four basic policies toward Israel. Number one, we will never make peace with Israel. Number two, we will never negotiate with Israel over anything. Number three, we will never recognize that Israel is there as a nation. And number four, we will never cease our efforts to return the territory of Israel to the Palestinian Arabs. These four principles guide Saddam Hussein today. And if you understand this, then you understand what he's out to do. Well, Israel occupied the bank of the Suez Canal and the Sinai Peninsula. Jordanian and Palestinian terrorists harassed the Israeli settlements for years following. Syria became a base for their terrorist operations. Russia rearmed the Arabs, and preparations went forward for the next full effort to fulfill Satan's desire to kill the Jews. Things rolled along until October 6, 1973. Was the most sacred holy day of the Jewish people, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Nationwide, transportation was halted. Shops and businesses were closed. People were observing this religious holiday. The Jews, unfortunately, the military, had fallen into a false sense of security because of their previous, almost easy victories over overwhelming Arab superiority, forgetting that it was God who was stepping in to make this provision and to look to Him for that kind of further security. Suddenly, without any indication and any anticipation on the part of the Jews, huge masses of Egyptian from the south and Syrian forces from the north attacked Israel from two directions to create a two-pronged offensive to put Israel into the prongs of a nutcracker. A million Arab soldiers were turned loose. They had 5,400 tanks, 980 planes, and 185 anti-aircraft batteries, basic. They came against Israel with all of it. The Israeli army was now outnumbered 12 to 1. The Jewish forces were completely surprised. They were shocked by the onslaught, and they had to fall back in retreat on both fronts to absorb the initial impact of the attack. For 3 days, they desperately fought to stem the tide in the north and in the south. They fought a delaying action in the Sinai against Egypt. Syria was reinforced by Iraq, Jordan, Morocco, and other surrounding countries. Things were getting worse for the Jews by the day. The Israeli concentrated an offensive in the north against Syria and the Allies because they considered that this was the most critical point of the attack. They set up a perimeter defense to hold the Egyptians in restraint, and they went after Israel. And they went after Syria. By the end of the first week, they were shelling Damascus. The tide was again turning by the grace of God. Then they turned southward toward Egypt, whose armor was defeated in the desert. I mean, that desert was strewn with armored vehicles until it was unbelievable what people were seeing out there. The Israelis crossed the Suez Canal, and they came charging in around behind the Arab behind the Egyptian positions, behind the Arab positions, to the rear of the Egyptian army. What they intended to do was to move toward Cairo and in the process pinch off the Egyptian army and this time totally destroy them. So there's nobody left alive. They were going to follow the biblical principle of destroy your enemy's ability to make war. Russia called the American president and said, you better stop them. If you do not stop them, we're going to come in and we will come into this war on the Arab side. Again, the United States government called the government of Israel and said, you have to stop the offensive. And in this war, Israel lost 2,500 men killed. 25% of them were officers. It was bad enough to lose 2,500 men, but to lose leadership to that degree, 25% of this was leadership, officers, was an even greater blow. To give you some comparison of what this meant, 2,500 men lost out of the population of Israel at that time would be like a week's offensive and the United States losing 20,000 men. For the little nation of Israel, it was an enormous blow. 2,500 men would have been like 20,000 to us. Israel learned, however, something from this war, that she must anticipate Arab aggression and to strike first and not give them a chance to get started. She found also that she doesn't have very many friends in the world. She found she had to be militarily and industrially self-reliant. Jews all over the world, however, showed that they cared about Israel and they were ready to help. 10 million of the world's 13 million Jews today live outside of Israel, and those 10 million rallied to their support. The Israelis want to include in their military forces Jews from around the world. Obviously, you can see that the Jews need a friend. All this has done is enrage the Arabs all the more. The result of the Yom Kippur War convinced, however, Egypt's president, Anwar Sadat, that the course of wisdom was to let Israel exist as a nation and to sign a peace treaty, which he did in April of 1979. In keeping with that peace treaty, the Israelis agreed to give back the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt, and they, in return, Egypt recognized Israel as a nation, the only Arab country that has done that. The issue of Palestinian Arab autonomy in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, however, was left unresolved. The Arab nations cannot win a war against Israel without Egypt, and therefore they were enraged with Sadat. They expelled Egypt from the Arab League. They isolated Egypt in every way, and in time arranged for the assassination of President Sadat. Today, the friction with Israel continues. It continues now over the occupied West Bank. The Arabs want the West Bank to be given to the Palestinians to make a new country, a country of Palestine in this territory. That means that the Jews would have to give up Jerusalem. They would have to give up defensible perimeters. And I remember when I was in Israel, our guide was taking us down here toward the Dead Sea to Masada, that famous site where the Jews held out to the very end, and then finally the rest of them committed suicide up on that high mount when the Romans were trying for something like a year to bring them down. But I remember his telling us that we can drive directly to Masada. It will not take us so long. He said previous to the Yom Kippur War, we have to do all this. Make a long circuitous route. Took many, many hours longer to get there. Now they had access all over the country, and that was very important for defensive purposes. So the West Bank has 650,000 Arabs who now resent Israeli control, and that's why you have the friction. The Israelis have carried on an intensive Jewish colonization of this territory. I think they're smart. They're coming to wherever there's a strong enclave of Arabs, they surround it with a colony of Jews. And they're filling this territory with colonists. That is smart. The Jewish West Bank is surrounded by violent Arab population, and the Arabs, as you've been hearing over the last couple of years, have the Intifada, which is a rebellion against Jewish authority in the West Bank area. But you see, to the Jews, they remember that this is Judea and this is Samaria. And they refer to it by their biblical names. And they remind people that it is our ancient right to own Judea and Samaria. It is not the right of the Arabs to possess that. Some Jews want to simply drive all the Arabs from the West Bank. That's not practical. The United Nations General Assembly in 1980 voted to form a Palestinian sovereign state out of the West Bank territory. That's what the Jews face with the United Nations now, which once voted to create the nation of Israel, now wants to deny them the West Bank and to create, instead of it, a Palestinian state. They want Israel to withdraw from all the territories occupied in the 1967 war. Israel refuses to leave the West Bank and certainly refuses to leave Jerusalem. It really enraged the Jews. It really enraged the Arabs when the Jews finally did what I'm glad they did, declared that Jerusalem is their capital. On June 7, 1981, Israel saw on the horizon a man who was determined to destroy them as a nation by the name of Saddam Hussein. Their intelligence system is so keen and so accurate that they got the information that Saddam was building a nuclear reactor. When it was complete, he'd be able to, on his own, create nuclear weapons, and guess what he was going to do with them? It was his intention to simply nuke the land of Israel and to destroy the Jewish settlements and the Jewish people. On June the 7th of 1981, you may remember that the Israelis bombed the reactor, blew it to pieces. Isn't it interesting to ask ourselves, where would we be today? Where would this situation in the Gulf be today if that reactor had been permitted to go online and nuclear weapons at Saddam's disposal? The problem is, we don't know that he doesn't have them. Iraq is an implacable enemy of Israel. This whole Gulf situation now had it its ultimate objective to destroy the Jew. Saddam was going to go in and take Kuwait, take Saudi Arabia. Now he controlled 50% of the world's oil and its reserves. Then he was going to go after the Jew with his million-man army. And what nations of the world are going to want to get too much involved who are dependent upon that oil that he now would have controlled? Is God doing something or what? Again, stepping in at a critical point to protect the Jews. And Saddam Hussein now sits there frustrated once more, the latest Arab to try to fulfill Satan's dream of destroying the entire Jewish nation. It is because there is a Savior in heaven, the Jewish Messiah, who is going to come and take away all the authority from Gentile nations, place it in his own hands as a benevolent dictator, and establish the Jewish people as the leading nation on the face of the earth, with the Christian church as his agents of administration. And when that happens, Satan is kaput. He goes into the pit of the abyss for 1,000 years. The world enters its golden age, and all of Satan's agents, like Saddam Hussein, are doing the best to delay that event. But they are doomed. All their efforts are doomed. The Jew is in Israel, and he's there to stay. The flag of Israel will continue to wave the time will come when the Jew will respect the significance of the Star of David as now worn by the only legitimate king by genealogical descent, which is the Lord Jesus Christ, the only king alive who can rule, and they will someday respect those two blue stripes, and they will indeed become again a people of the Word of God. May we be an example to them in that respect. Our Father, we thank you so much for this time in the Word of God.